Good evening and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Monday, June 12th, 2000. In the fireside room this evening, Andy Gordon will begin a series entitled Technology in Progress, The Promise and the Peril. Tonight's session is entitled Introduction to Information Technology, Issues and Implications. This is session GOA 2000-1. Let's listen in and see what we can hear.
Whether they have an email address.
Max Lillia, and I do have an email address.
I'm married to her.
You have her email. Why don't we just go?
My name is Sonia, and I have two email addresses.
My name is Dale, and I have an email address.
I'm Roger, and we also have an email.
Right.
I'm Julia. I have an address, but my secretary is the only one who knows how to use it.
I'm Janet. I live in Holden.
But Holden has a web page.
I have a web page, and I've never touched email.
First, Jeff and I have an email through email.
And I have one with Jeff, but I never check.
Liz, I have one. I didn't get enough responses from the emails I sent out to grandchildren, so I dumped it.
These children just won't use technology. Isn't that the trouble?
That's right. I'm her spouse.
I'm Cindy. We have two email addresses, and the two services are fighting with each other, so neither one ever works.
Okay, good. One is AOL, right?
One's AOL, the AOL. Other one is US West.
If two services are fighting with one another, one is AOL.
I'm Chris, and I have the two that she has that doesn't work, and plus I have one that works.
I'm Darren, and I have email.
I'm Steve. I have one at work and one at home.
I'm Mike, and I have one, but it's long.
But it's long?
Yeah.
Okay, well, that's
instead
fine.
Instead of having just .com, it's, you know, well, of course, it's Danenet, WICIP,
sure.
et cetera, so right. Skip it. Go ahead, man.
I'm Ron, and I have an email.
I'm Jeannie, and I have one at home and one at work.
I'm Matt, and I have two emails.
Ron, I have one at home and one at work.
I go and I have an email.
I'm Michael, and I have evil mail.
Well, I'm almost embarrassed to say I have six emails.
All right.
Bob, I have one more.
I'm Jolene, and I have emails. I'm
Margo,
and I have emails.
I'm Gaylord, and I'm like Jolene. My secretary uses one of them.
Well, the main reason I wanted to do that is because the last time I was at Holden was 14 years ago. And I don't think I could have gotten people to understand what email was, much less to collude in the way this room of people who view the world differently, who want to stand apart from what most of the world is doing. We have to notice at least how, either for reasons of seduction or for reasons of its real value to us or because we want to be participants in the new world, we have found ourselves unable to resist this technology, which I know when it first came up, most people, including me, said, never me, never me. I'll be able to, you know, the regular post offices work fine for me. That snail mail we all deride all the time because it takes so long. And even with the impact it has on all of us, it used to be that the argument about email was it was asynchronous, which meant that it wasn't like a phone. You had to be on the end of the line at the same time as the other person in order to have a message. It was asynchronous. The two of us could be operating in different time spaces. But I think what that has had the impact on most of us of meaning, we're expected to look at our mail all the time rather than look at, answer our phone calls occasionally. So there's a way in which it has infested and infected our lives that also has to be thought about. Now, I think part of the, there's some very easy technical issues that I think most people find themselves on the other side of understanding, that I hope I can sufficiently introduce you to so that they're no longer just mysterious. Partly because they're interesting, I think, in and of themselves, and partly because there are implications associated with these technical twists and turns that the world has taken that will come back to be systematically important as we discuss policy issues, the building of community, who stands outside, who stands inside, and so on. One of these that's probably the most important is digital, the nature of digital information. Let's spend a little time on that. And then let me use that as a launch pad to talk about a number of other related matters that I think are still pretty important to understand. Digital information, it has so many implications that aren't evident on the surface. The binary number system that digital information is based on only has two characters, 0 and 1. It's either on or off. Either the current is passing through a line or it isn't. Either the current is high voltage or low voltage or whatever. Now that seems like an awfully clumsy way to deliver a complicated message. Why not use our number system and our letter system? The basic reason for this is that it's something that computers do uniquely well. They're able to make a decision about whether a current is being passed or not, whether a switch is on or off, very quickly. And they can make, at this point, billions of such decisions in a second. And if you put enough binary digits in a row, you can reproduce anything. When the binary system was first set up, it was set up by people who worked on computers, mostly mathematicians. And all they thought they had to do was reproduce the number system. So the first basic set of dictionaries that translated letters and numbers into binary representations. There's a wonderful story underlying the number system, but I don't think we have to spend time on it. I'll just say one quick thing, just so, some people will get it right away and some people won't get it at all, and it's okay, but I want at least to have made that point. In the binary system, this is the number 1. In the binary system, this is the number 2, and this is the number 3, and so on. What do I mean by so on? I mean the following. Now let me just say this very quickly. Don't worry about not getting it, but it may be, for some of you, a breakthrough. If you look at a number in the number system you're used to, 234, it's actually equal to 4 times 10 to the 0 power, plus 3 times 10 to the 1st power, plus 2 times 10 squared. These are powers of 10 as you move to the left, and powers of 10 actually as you move to the right. The binary system, these are powers of 2. So when we have a 2, we actually have 2. A 2 is equal to 0 times 2 to the 0 power plus 1 times 2 to the 1st power. And so when you have the number 4, you need 3 columns, powers of 2, okay? The logic is the same as the number system we're used to. It just operates on what's called a different base. But that base makes it.
You use the black marker, that's very hard to see.
Well, okay, except that I saw earlier that, well, this one is working a little bit. Yes, okay, good, thank you. So that sort of, for those of us who are used to the number system we know best, this just seems complicated. Let me tell you some of the advantages. These advantages turn out to have massive implications. One of them is it's clean. It's very simple. Its simplicity is one of its basic values. Most of the information communication we're used to is analog. When I speak, I send out a waveform which is reproduced in my ear. That complex waveform of air is passed on to my ear. When you hear a speaker with music coming out of it, it's, if you looked at it, it's actually a pulsating waveform. And the amplifier makes it large, makes it loud enough for our ears to be able to hear. Before the digital system, information was analog, and now it's digital. Now let's I want to take this in a couple directions. The first is, well, imagine that all you needed, that I was standing on the other side of the room, speaking softly, muffling my voice. It might be very hard for people in the back of the room even to know what I'm talking about. Because you have to take this complex wave and pick it up and have it effectively communicated to your ears. But if I was standing over here and all you had to know was whether my arm was up or not, that'd be an easy message for you to pick up. So for example, when pictures are sent from the moon, they are sent as a series of ones and zeros. And so the pictures that arrive eventually on our television screen can be faithful reproductions of what it is that's being sent from the moon because of the simplicity of the message. All they have to know is whether a pulse is being sent or not, and then they have to know how to gather those pulses into interpretable events. That's one thing. Turns out to make it to be a powerful underpinning of the decision to go in a digital direction. Speed, computers operate very quickly with binary digits. And so we can communicate millions and billions of pieces of information simultaneously. So the fact, those facts about digital are important, and there are many others. Now let me tell you one other that I think is the phenomenon of our time that's least well understood. When information is sent over the internet or sent to your email package, we have to know not only the content of that message, but we have to know exactly who it's coming from and who it's going to. All that information is sent digitally. When the system that's called the internet was originally set up, it was set up in order to allow the government to continue to be able to operate even if the silos in Kansas that were holding the atomic bombs blew up. The way the internet was designed was with a great deal of robustness, so that if one path between here in New York or here in Minneapolis or here in Florida were interrupted, it wouldn't matter. It'd just take another path. And then when the information was communicated, let's imagine we were in Washington and we were trying to get a message to Minneapolis or Minnesota. That message might come through several paths simultaneously. So I might type the word hello, let's imagine it was a long message. That long message might be sent by several paths. So just for simplicity, the H might come by way of Florida. The E might come by way of Chicago. The L might come by way of Oklahoma. And this is what's happening now. But when it arrived, it would be successfully sent in such a way that the order of the message was made clear. The robustness that made that possible is the reason why, for example, I don't have to wait for you to finish your email messages before I can send mine. and we can all operate simultaneously because little bits are sent, and then they're put together at the arriving end. The decision was made in order that we'd be able to survive an atomic attack with our information apparatus intact. But beneath it is something that's allowed a lot of simultaneous use and allowed the growth of this technology that we've all noticed we have become dependent upon. I hope I don't lose anybody here, but I think this is very important. So let me try to communicate. If the word, now hello is standing for a long message. If it were as short as hello, it would go in one burst. But let's imagine it was the Library of Congress, which can also send all its content in a single message. If that were to happen, the message is sent and it's surrounded by additional information. For example, who's sending this sucker? And who's this going? Who is it going to? And if it has to go in 500 individual pieces, interrupted by your message and yours and yours, which one of this is this in order? So the first one will have an 01 on it, and the second piece will have an 02 on it, and the third will have an 03 on it, and so on. And when they arrive, they are assembled in the proper order, no matter what order they got there in. Are you with me? Now, this concept where you have not only the message as binary digits, bits means binary digits, but you have this other information that goes along with it is called encapsulation. So the message itself, the only thing you think you're interested in, is encapsulated in a packet. Have you heard about packet switching and packets of information being sent? Is encapsulated in a packet of information that includes all of this. Now, what's important about this? From your point of view, the only part of this that might be interesting is the word hello. But from industry's point of view, what might be important is who's sending what messages to whom. How often do they visit my website? How much time do they spend on every page? What have they bought recently? Are you with me? This information turns out often, from the point of view of industry, to be more important than that. So they pull this information off. They interrupt the bit stream, or what's called click stream, when you use your mouse. They interrupt the bit stream, take off information, and all of a sudden know things about you you didn't even imagine you were sending. Because from the point of view of the computer that's interrupting this message and interpreting it, they're equivalently interpretable digits. That also means, because we're worried about information arriving with integrity through these various devices, that every message you sent is out there somehow on many computers simultaneously. So the fact that you have received something, for example, and erased it, doesn't mean it isn't out there for somebody else to pick off in one of those intermediary computers where it arrived all the way to where you were going. So there's all kinds of things happening behind the scenes that make the information you're sending and the information about to whom you are talking and where you're going and what you're doing valuable as commodities that most people don't understand. Now let me push this in one other direction and then hope to have a conversation. If you were to take a microscope and look at a vinyl pressed record, what you would see are hills and valleys that look like what will be amplified to go through speakers and would then arrive into your ears as tones you would interpret. The problem is that those hills and valleys consist not only of the signal, the music, let's say, that's on that record, but the scratches, the times when you drop that record, the imperfections in the needle, all of that thing, all of that information that you may consider noise is indistinguishable on a vinyl record from the signal you thought you were interested in. One of the most important issues about encapsulation, and excuse me, let me make one more intermediate step. A digital record, or a CD, consists only of ones and zeros. But one of the most important parts about that record is what isn't on it. All those scratches, all those times when it was dropped, all that occasional noise that was in the room between the microphone and the performer. So when digital information is sent, it not only says who it's from and who it's to, but now we have music, and the from is from the CD, and the to is to my amplifier. But it tells the amplifier anything else that arrives that doesn't have this information on it is irrelevant and is to be ignored. So there's no extraneous noise in the system. That's how digital TVs are different. You'll never have ghosting on a digital TV because the receiving instrument knows what it's supposed to receive and what it's supposed to ignore. So the encapsulation is important not only for what it tells you is central to your message, but what is irrelevant to your message. Now, let me take this one more step. That is called fidelity. Records were thought to be fidelity, remember? And then we talked about high fidelity, which meant they were even more faithful. You can't talk about faithful without talking about what you're trying to be faithful to. And when you begin to talk about faithfulness entirely in technical terms, then we're just ignoring the information that somebody has said is unimportant, but we're looking at it in technical terms only. So behind the decision to have ever more comprehensive descriptions of the information that a person is writing or the sounds on a record or so on is a decision about things that are irrelevant. Faithfulness, I think, is an interesting concept for us to bring in because it's thought about in solely technical terms in the information industry. And yet, there are deeper questions, I think, that arise about what is it we're leaving out of what we thought was important in a piece of communication, because it cannot be represented digitally. Digital understanding makes us make decisions, and they may not be the ones we would make as human beings if we were trying faithfully to represent a conversation, for example. So all this background about how digital information works and its value is worth paying attention to. The additional step that the internet takes us to is that because of the way it operates, every machine is able to pass information to every other machine. Any individual computer can be either a sender or receiver of information. So if any of you decided you wanted to do it, you could have your own website, your own web pages, your own information that you're communicating to the world. It's no longer the purview of a handful of people who make decisions about what's to be communicated. Now, that was never intended in order to bring everybody to the table as full participants in conversation, but it's a legacy of the technical design behind the system. The question becomes, what's its value to us because of the design? How can we take advantage of it? And what are the costs that it represents to us? Because there are so many people at the table delivering messages which may not have passed through certain intermediaries we may think of as helping us interpret what's going on. I have several examples of places where computers make huge mistakes. And we tend often to notice when our email doesn't arrive successfully or when things go wrong. For example, a student once gave me a wonderful message that came from the Reader's Digest, where they were soliciting new clients. And they'd done it in some benighted database where this letter had gone out to Mrs. Mother Superior and the Superior family. Because they just picked up a certain field and decided that was the last name, and picked up another field and decided that was the first name, and so on. And I keep a letter that I received from an agency dunning me and insisting they would take me to court if I didn't pay the $0.00, which I owed. These aggressive letters. And because people have gotten so used to what they see as the depersonalization of this system, how many of you have had the experience of receiving a solicitation where it will look like somebody's written on it? It will actually be mass-produced, but they will have done somebody's scrawl in red ink. They'd be sure to forward this to George right away. Right. Trying to bring us back, seduce us back into thinking that this thing that's being done on a mass scale is actually being done on an individual scale. Let me give you some examples of how this technology works that I think, in many ways may surprise you. Hope I can do this without overheads, but I'm not sure. Just one second. Yeah. I think one of the pages here it is. If any of you are subscribers to the major newspapers and new major magazines, look at them carefully. Because in fact, this that we're looking at is a unique magazine. There's absolutely none like it in the world. If you look at the cover of Yours As With Ours, you'll notice that the name appears on the bottom, not as a piece that's been glued onto the top, but actually printed onto the page. Notice that they've made it look like it used to when it was the old dot matrix print, so once again it looks like somebody's gone to some trouble to produce it. But in fact, this is mass produced. Now those code numbers don't tell you a lot, but what you don't realize in looking at this is that behind this is lots of other information, which may be equally compelling for various reasons I hope to illustrate to you. Unfortunately, I don't have the overhead on this, but let me show you. I better step back there. I'm sorry, there's going to be a little bit of going back and forth. This is a page from that printed with and contained in that magazine I showed you. My wife's name is Margot. And at the top of this printed page it says, "Margaret, don't settle for mediocrity. Bring your next presentation to life during the great presentation sale. The Kinko's nearest you is open right now at 1833 Broadway, Seattle." This was printed and contained within the magazine. Now, that may be a small matter, and you can think of the efficiencies involved with this. But this also means that with the same technology, they can decide which editorial pages to send to us, which content advertising pages to send to us. So because of the neighborhood we live in, they may think we're interested in rock music, but not classical music. We do not have a standard national forum in the same way that we did. because these things are prepackaged for our purposes. And the technology makes this able to happen behind the scenes. What I'm most interested in surfacing here are not the things that frustrate you, like the email that isn't arriving, but what the technology in its power lets happen behind the scenes in ways you're paying no attention to. One of my favorite experiences was what I call my 1-800 surprise phone call. I saw something on the television that I was interested in, and I called up to order this widget. And it took, I didn't catch on right away, but I said I'd like to buy this widget, and they said, and yes, Mr. Gordon, do you still live at, wherever we lived at the time, 5307 South Hudson? And do you still own a Macintosh? And so, wait a minute. For just a minute, I said, I don't remember telling you anything, not even my name, not even my phone number. And the woman laughed and said, oh, well, you see, we have caller ID. And so when you call, we know what number you came from. And we've bought several databases about what you own and what you're interested in and what your computer is. And so as soon as that phone number comes up, it's a key for us. And the key opens up all these databases. And we know what other products we're interested in selling. I didn't use that language, of course. Whatever wonderful things we have to offer you that we didn't have time to talk about on television. And so this becomes our opportunity to tell you what else, what other value we may bring to you. All this is happening because digital information makes it possible for so many kinds of things to be combined. And because there are such efficiencies in that. So let me give you a few other examples. I want to have a conversation about this, but I wanted to be sure we've at least covered what I think is the waterfront in this area. One of the things computers, how many of you have learned to type by using one of the typing tutor programs? Do any of you know those? There's some famous ones. Mavis teaches typing is one that a lot of people use. The reason those programs work so well is because, and they, by the way, this is an area in which computers are, I think, better than humans at doing the teaching. Because the way the computer operates, it's monitoring every keystroke. It knows exactly how long you're pressing every key. So it knows, for example, what key combinations you're having to struggle with. Where do you slow down as you're trying to get through the message that it gives you? So I can take that information and give you one specifically designed to work on your problem. So it's very interactive with you. Why is that possible? Because the way the technology operates, when you press a key, you're no longer pressing a piece of metal against the paper. It's no longer a one-step process. In fact, it's an electric pulse. And that pulse is picked up and interpreted as a letter to reproduce. In order to do that effectively, they have all this other information. Again, it's the behind-the-scenes part of this I'm trying to get at. That is important. But that also means that secretaries can be monitored to see how quickly they're working. The same technology can intercept anything. So it makes you a better typist. It makes secretaries crazy. So there are lots of people in organizations now who are having their work monitored on a minute-to-minute basis and get reports at the end of the hour saying, Mary, you're not keeping up. You might think of the technology as being relatively neutral with respect to all these things, but who controls the technology? And to what purposes might it be put? OSHA did a study where in the same organization they looked at secretaries who were working with new information technology and bosses. At the time this was done, bosses loved it. They saw it as liberating because of all the work that they could do that they were unable to do otherwise and all the control they had over in their organization. In that same organization, OSHA reported that the secretaries had the highest level of anxiety that they had caught in any other group than air traffic controllers. The way this organization had decided to work was that they decided some secretaries were good at editing, some were good at rewriting and so on, and so they got exactly what they were good at and nothing else. So they were re-put on assembly line, and they would get three pages from one piece of work without having any idea what it came from or what its content was. When they were through with that, they get three other pages. They were completely alienated from their work because the technology made it possible, and because the decisions about how that technology was being deployed were entirely in other hands. So it's an interesting problem where we can see for ourselves the efficacy of this for our lives, but also I think beginning to see for ourselves the way in which it is imposing itself on us in ways we might not have imagined. I also want you to think, again, this is the behind the scenes thing I'm trying to develop here. We think of computers as these boxes put out by IBM and Compact and so on. In fact, the computer that's working with these digits is just a little microprocessor. The heart of the computer is a very small piece of equipment getting smaller and smaller every year. So, while we may say that Holden is not particularly computerized, that I noticed they were asking for another IBM PC. In fact, I venture that there are 50 to 60 computers in this room, in our watches, in our hearing aids, in this, in that, in the control of the heat and electrical systems. These are all digital devices which operate on some sort of message that has been left behind them as part of programming. So computerization has worked its way into our system for good or ill in ways that many of us are unaware of. Now remember I said, and I think this will be my last illustration before we have a conversation. Remember I said that, there are a couple things I guess that I'd like to point out here. The first is this wonderful tale that a friend of mine puts at the end of his email. Computers are getting smaller and smaller all the time. You know, there's something called Moore's Law that says every 18 months they get twice as fast and half as expensive. So that now, you know, we're worried about the speed of light. There's something that's slowing down our computers. They have to get smaller just so they can continue to operate, because the speed of light takes too long to get the signal through, because the signals are all able to operate so quickly. Whatever this is, whether the way the speed has changed and the productivity, quote unquote, in this sense of fidelity that I was talking about has changed, whatever that is something which has been going on for about 20 years and nobody sees any reason for it not to continue into the future. So, in light of that, this friend of mine sends this message that said, if automobiles had experienced the same technological process as the computer, automobiles would travel about 400 miles on a gallon of gas, their engines would generate 40,000 horsepower, they would cost less than $500, and they would blow up at least once a week. Remember I said that if you're going to send these encapsulated messages, you have to be able to know uniquely who it's coming from and who it's going to. And you have to be able to reassemble them in these parts that sort of make sense of the message at the other end. And that's been worked out in this extraordinary way by the protocol called TCPIP, Transport Control Protocol, Internet Protocol. If any of you are using the internet, you've got an IP address whether you know it or not. They'll create one for you, because otherwise the whole system doesn't work. It requires this. It also means that every one of you, when you're on the net, unless you're using your husband's or wife's email system, or every one of you who is accessing an internet site, has to be uniquely identified. And how many of you have visited sites where you wanted to go further and it required more information of you? It wanted you to tell them something about yourself. Maybe it required a credit card number, said it wouldn't use it. It wasn't requiring you to buy anything. But that credit card number is their signal by which they can go out and find out all these other things. So you think all you've done is let yourself get past the gate. Well, what you've done for them is open, the rainbow. Well, because every address has to be unique, we've identified these tails that work. For example, .com is typically a company. .org is another kind of organization. Most nonprofits are .org. .edu typically means educational institution, and so on. The government is .gov. If you go to the White House, by typing whitehouse.gov, this is what you get. Now, there are several points I want to make here, but I think we may do this in a later session. One of the most important is, this is paid for by the government, and yet it is in its entirety an advertisement for the vice president and president. You aren't going to find anything about Monica Lewinsky on this site. Nor are you going to find anything from the arbiters, who may have a different perspective on how well the government is. So this is wholly owned by the United States government and wholly controlled, even though it's taxpayers' money, by the present incumbents. This is what you get when you go to whitehouse.gov. Now, what I want to show you, and I don't want to offend anybody, but I have an important message that I want to deliver.
The other
five
percent.
This is what you get when, if you don't know what you're doing, as many children don't, you go to whitehouse.org or whitehouse.com, or in many systems, just type White House, because it has to make a decision about what you mean. This is the website. This is http://whitehouse.com. Somebody has been clever enough to figure out how they can bring themselves to the attention of a lot of people who are just looking at the White House. And by the way, accidentally or not, a lot of kids who are just out there doing research and don't know what they're up to. The government was furious at this when they saw it, but it turns out they can't control it in any way. They have no control over the addresses. They just have to be unique. That's what's required. They managed to get one of the companies to back off, but the other responded by having a White House intern of the week on their side. That was their response to the government, giving telling them how they were supposed to do their business. So the fact that anybody can be a producer of information sounds wonderful. I can give you lots of examples, and I will in a later session. But it also means we've opened up the world to an array of difficulties, problems for children, problems for adults, information overload issues, and so on, that were not anything any of us had to think about 14 years ago when I was here and nobody knew what email was. The future isn't what it used to be. And one of the things I'm pointing out is it's if anything, escalating in that direction. So the penetration continues. The assaults on community that we might think about, and I hope we begin the discussion of, are here as well. So there's promise and peril associated with this technology. Almost all the money, most of the thinking, is going to the promise. Most of the promise has an industrial flavor to it. I think the people who want to come to Holden and think about a different way to address the world cannot treat this as something that can be ignored. If the rest of the world is ignoring it, and there are very few people who want to turn their sights to the ominous issues that we probably should be thinking through as best we can. Certainly not as many people who are thinking about as are thinking about the corporate interests. I talked to somebody in Seattle who works for the world's largest software company, which shall remain nameless, who's at a very high level in the organization, who told me that their job is to make a profit. That's their responsibility. They have stakeholders and stockholders, and if they didn't, they should lose their job. Our job is to look over their shoulders and make sure it doesn't get out of control. And he turns to the policy people and says, "Are you?" And I'm turning to the people of faith and saying, "Are you doing your job?" that's a conversation starter. Are there any comments people want to make at this point?
Yes, Taylor. Technical question. Earlier when we were talking about the, people screening the tubes and the prompts, who governs the internet? Is that FCC?
No, there are actually organizations. There's an internet society. It used to be the only people who decided what the addressing scheme must be. And even that has been privatized now because they realized that the ones who collected $75 per year from every internet site were making a mint because all they had to do was sign somebody up once. And so now there are several companies in competition with one another. And in fact, the addressing scheme you used to with the .edu, .com, and so on is about to become more multifaceted. So supposedly you'll be able to more precisely identify what an internet site is.
Yeah. It's the same. It seems like the beginning, the oasis for any intervention is fantastic, but then it always has a tendency to slide downhill. I think even with the invention of the telephone was great, but then eventually now you can go into get into phone sex hotlines, 1-800 numbers, and a lot of stuff where it's kind of gone off the edge. It's the same thing with television. Television was great when it first started, but now it's kind of gone downhill. And it could have been the same thing with computers. You know, it's that the life cycle from a morality standpoint. At first, it's great. Everybody communicates with one another, but then people go ahead and they start to abuse it.
It's an excellent point. I think I've been in three sessions today in the audience. And where at the end the person who was running the session asked, what are the essential issues here we have to deal with? And on every list, the word profit came on. And I don't think we're immune from that here either. Where's the money? Follow the money. And where's the money to be made? In every technology, by the way, if we have time to do this week, but the history of technology is fascinating in this regard as well. The places at which in the past things have gone awry, the places where the industry has decided it had to respond. You know, this privacy issue that we're concerned about now, there's no privacy right in the Constitution, but most of the places where people have been concerned about in the past about privacy have been when new technologies made a difference and people began to worry about it. So one of the most famous rulings about privacy was by Justice Brandeis. This was provoked when newspapers were first able to publish pictures rather than just drawings of people. And rich people didn't like them all of a sudden being identified. And so they sued to keep their pictures off the front page. But it was a technological breakthrough that made it necessary to rethink privacy. And I think we are once again in much of in the same place. Let me give you another interesting example of how technology differences have changed our life in ways that we never think about after it's happened. This is something, by the way, a friend of ours calls a creeping event. Mm-hmm. Things happening a little bit at a time, and all of a sudden the world is changing. We don't even know it. If somebody were to come from Mars after having been away 15 years, they would think it isn't the same world anymore with respect to technology. I was mentioning to Jody that our son graduated from college last year. As far as we can tell, he and every one of his friends now has a job that didn't exist 5 years ago. It isn't that they weren't thinking of doing it. They couldn't have thought of doing it because there was no such job to be had. And it's an amazing shift. And yet moves along at a pace that we often don't notice. There was a time when Illinois had about 27 time zones. I don't know how many of you know that. How could that possibly be? Think profit, think corporation, think local economies. It used to be that you only had to know what time it was. And as is still true, in fact, with respect to those people with whom you were in relationship or with whom you were doing business. So they would be the people in your surrounding area. So large towns would define the time for that area. And so it was approximately the same, of course. We knew approximately what new was. And what they would do in order to identify, in many of these towns, in order to identify noon so people could set their clocks, would be that they go to the top of the tallest building and they would drop something that everybody could see. Times Square is a vestige of that. That's what that's about. Dropping something at the turn of the century or the end of the year. But that originated because people in a local area didn't know what time it was. What do you think changed that?
Trains.
The railroad. Because now you had to know when the train was going to arrive. And the thing that was coupled with that was another technological breakthrough, the telegraph. The telegraph was the first information device in the history of the world where the message arrived before the messenger. Unless you count smoke signals. That was, just think of that. Again, you don't think about it at the time, but think of what it meant to be able to send a message everywhere simultaneously without having to get there yourself. Mm-hmm. This is how NBC, David Sarnoff started NBC. David Sarnoff was a telegraph operator that signaled that the Titanic was going down. And he said, this is interesting. This is important. He realized what the technology could do that other people didn't understand and what was possible. Now we could have a national network. The breakthroughs in computers are mostly the people who realized that this is not just a machine where the engineers can do their math. The original data types were numbers and then letters, so you could illustrate your numbers. But then once you get into the digital space, say, why not pictures? Why not animation? Why not color? They can all be represented digitally. So the breakthroughs are when people push the boundaries by understanding what the technology allows. I think this simultaneity and the fact that everybody can be the producer has great value, but it has to be understood for a valuable commodity from people who care in the same ways that corporate interests are pushing it for their purpose. Yes, sir.
Are you aware of any evidence that would speak to the industrial cycle or business cycles? We grew up thinking that there'd be an ebb and flow, and it's based on industrial production and storage and demand and supply. In this new information age, where everybody's producers and consumers simultaneously, doesn't appear to have that kind of a rhythm.
You've hit on what people are thinking of as the new economy. And whether it's really a new economy or in fact these people are going to have to sell something of value is something that's still being worked out. And I think the Wall Street gurus are in battle among themselves. And of course, one camp lost a lot of money recently. But we don't know how that's going to play itself out. So I'm not sure. I'm not sure how those economic interests operate. Let me say a couple things, though. Because there are some ways in which the laws that exist have to be rethought. For example, intellectual property.
Yeah, that's what Bill Gates is saying.
It used to be that a lot of people had to think of the value of something was valuable because there was one of them, or because you controlled the few and you could sell those few for whatever the market was there. With information, it's impossible now to say there's only one. And there are people who say the new model of information for as intellectual property or anything that can be cast as intellectual property has to be, its value is how many people are interested in copies or whatever it is and what's a little bit of money I can get from every copy. There's nothing in the current intellectual property regime that captures that very well or figures out how to deal with it. So there are lots of things that have to do with ownership. Whose is this? What makes it mine? You've all heard about sampling, where somebody will hear something they like And for example, a drum, there's a famous case of somebody whose drum beat was wonderful. It was sampled by somebody else and put in his song, and he sued. He just said, I produced that. Sampling means that with great fidelity to the original sound, I can just take it off the internet. Everybody knows about MP3, and many of you, I think, know this is ways in which music is made available, and all of a sudden, near digital quality, CD quality sound can be downloaded for free by other people. It's going to be a very hard faucet to turn off. And so the businesses that produce that kind of intellectual property are scrambling to figure out how they can protect their rights and the rights of the people whose original material it was in this whole new way of thinking of things. So I think there are some ways in which we're really stuck and haven't figured out how to get ourselves out. What I'm trying to talk about as well are ways in which we're stuck in thinking about how the value of this for corporate purposes, whereas this same technology, properly developed, has a lot of value for other things. But somebody has to work on that with the fervor, if not the planning, and not the funding that the corporate interests are. And I think it can be done. Yeah.
In light of our Bible study talking about the stress of producers and the speed, how important was the fact that an intermediate step in the acceleration of exchange of information? I can remember, you know, last year it was okay for information to go take 3 to 5 days. Then we woke up one morning, everything had to be there in hours. You know, and then from the fact now we're momentary. So, I mean, was that an important
moment? Let me put it this way. How many businesses, large and small, do you know that don't have fax machines? How many people think they can do without them? Actually, it's interesting. The fax machine has particular value that computers still are unable to reproduce. They're equally comfortable in any language. Some people say that the major reason in which the Chinese had to eventually pull back in Tiananmen Square was the fax messages that were getting out about what was going on from the Chinese community that had fax machines in China to the rest of the world. So as of not so long ago, the Chinese tried to have every fax machine and every computer registered so that would never be possible. That kind of thing it's gotten so out of hand that no government can, it doesn't work. I mean, give lots of examples, Singapore and other places that have tried to control the free flow of information. And this raises an interesting question, sovereignty. What does it mean for any country to be sovereign and define what comes in and out of its borders if much of this is bits of information that are flowing electronically? How do they stop it from happening? There was a famous case in France where the French say that everything that's produced on the internet in France has to be produced in French. They've declared that. So there was a company, a U.S. business school, based in France, that wanted to attract students to its program. And so they produced their web pages about this program in English because they wanted only students who spoke English. This was a prerequisite for getting in. They didn't see this as a problem. They were sued by the French government. The French government said, you can't do that. I'm sorry. If it's based here, it has to be done in English. Right. So they sued. The people with the website lost, paid a $5,000 fine, set up their website the next day in America, and it's flowing into France the same as it was before. There was no way the French could control that. Once it became digital information, the site of a particular web service is now irrelevant. It can be anywhere. So a lot of things that have to do with sovereignty are on the table now as well. Now, is that the good news or the bad news? It depends on your analysis. It depends on what you're trying to achieve. It depends on whether we're one world. It depends on whether you want the Americanization of the world to persist, because that's really what we're talking about. 95% to 98% of the web pages are in English. I guess if you're an Anglophile, that's terrific.
I was going to say, I think though that countries I could foresee fighting, maybe not in terms of on the ground, but even with our information, how by way of computer viruses, and I realize it's the same thing over in the Philippines. I mean, they could basically wipe out all the information in the United States and we'd be at a standstill all the time. And so nobody would be killed, but our information would be dead.
There are some people that say that with, I don't know what number, but some number of well-placed electromagnets in the sky would be stopped dead. Because this is so much low-power equipment that can be interrupted by interrupting, can be successfully interrupted by magnetic fields. So, and there are many things that the story of the Philippines is wonderful. I just don't think we have time to get into it, but it has, they reacted to an attempt by Microsoft to get people to be able to program their email so they could use it in their own way. So they put something in that lets you program it, so somebody took advantage of it and tried to wipe everybody out. And so now Microsoft is having to back off. So one implication of that problem will be further standardization and further monopolization, because there are a few people out there who have tried to destroy the infrastructure.
I have security questions. Back to this security. Back in March, we made reservations for a trip to Australia on the internet. We're doing the same for a trip in August to Germany. And we've been sending our Visa card number. And we've had thoughts that this is not smart, but is it any worse than going to the restaurant and handing it to the waiter who takes it away and brings it back 10 minutes later?
This is not legal advice, so, right? I would say it's not as bad. I mean, if you ever leave your carbon copies behind, and certainly if you ever give your credit card number over the phone to somebody you've never met.
Do it all the time.
Then you're at least as vulnerable those ways, because if you really go to what they call a secure website, which they now have, that is a site which guarantees some sort of level of security as they get the information. That means that they've encoded it somehow, so it's still flowing the same way, but they've got some mechanism by which before it leaves your machine, it's scrambled, and then only they have the de-scrambler.
There's about 1 in 100 that think that's that way, at least that we've have dealt with.
Well, I'll tell you, I only give my card number out over a secure site.
What about an email?
There's so many interesting issues here. There's very little way in which email is protected. If you have confidential information and you really are interested in its confidentiality, I wouldn't send it by email. The number of people who have gotten in trouble this way at work because they don't realize that their email is not protected in the way, by law, in the way in which their snail mail is protected. People are not allowed to open your envelopes, but by law, in most places, your boss has the right to look at your email. It's produced with their equipment on their time. That's it. Well, we've run out of time. I think we're supposed to get it wrong. So thank you very much.